It's not possible to report on every public figure. Now, it's true that this public figure, after the development of the ages, in retrospect, proves to have been a very important historical figure. But that doesn't mean everybody in the days of Jesus saw it that way. In fact, there's evidence to believe that many people looked upon Jesus as just one more of those Jewish nutcases. They have so many messiahs these days, you know. It's an interesting theological speculation to ask, why is it in that period of time there are so many false messiahs showing up, you know? Because I believe in Satan and his work, I have something of an explanation of that that's worth looking at. But the fact is, people in Jesus' day might not have written on him because they just didn't think it was important, or may not even have heard of him. Is it hard to believe that a historian that's in Italy might not have heard of one Jewish teacher in Palestine? Even though, you know, 2,000 years later, we realize that one Jewish teacher gained a reputation that transformed the Western world. And so to expect independent confirmation is absolutely unreasonable. And yet he refutes these arguments, boom, boom, just like that. But now what does this tell us if we're evidentialists? It also tells us that if you're going to set that evidence out there and you think, now you've got a guy in a hammer lock and he can't get out, you're just wrong. Because he can do the very thing I've talked about. He can say, well, what you call evidence is not important to me. I marginalize that. And when you interpret the gospel accounts as there's two announcements of Jesus' birth, one to his biological mother, one to his legal father, an unbeliever has every right to say, well, that's not what you would expect. You'd expect one, so they obviously contradict themselves. Now, I've already told you, I think it's unreasonable. But you know, what you consider reasonable is going to be governed by what? Your basic presuppositions. Go ahead, somebody was going
to... I was going to say, if you apply his logic across the board for discounting the evidence of Jesus based upon those secondary... confirmation, you could say, for instance, in the Nuremberg trials, anything that the Nazis produced about themselves could not be used as evidence against them, mm-hmm. because they're biased.
Yeah. Well, he's probably referring to a principle, though, in courtroom procedure, where it's taken for granted that a witness that has a motive, let's say a man testifying in his own behalf, might not be telling the truth because he's trying to get himself out of trouble. Okay, so in some settings, you do have reason to think this motive could be affecting what he's saying. But in general, everybody's motivated for what they say. And obviously he's motivated, Michael Martin. So for him to dismiss Christians as being motivated is, first of all, a double standard. Secondly, it's an irrational or unreasonable expectation in historiography. And then lastly, it's a huge logical fallacy. You ever heard of the ad hominem fallacy? It's perfectly possible for a man who is motivated, perfectly possible for somebody who desires something to be true or false, nevertheless to tell the truth. Okay? I believe that Jesus is the Son of God. Now, does that discount all of what I've had to say over the last 2 days in defense of the Christian religion? I mean, you see, that doesn't make any sense. Because part of the reason I have put on a seminar like this is because I believe Jesus is the Son of God. So you can't dismiss what I've said in the seminar because of the reason for the seminar. Give you another illustration. It's sometimes argued against Walter Williams that we shouldn't accept what he has to say because he's agreeing with what Caucasian scholars have had to say. Walter Williams is a black writer.
What is that?
He's called an Uncle Tom for that reason. Well, but should the color of a person's skin affect the validity of his arguments one way or another? You see, it's interesting. When you go to college and you take a course in logic or, you know, intellectual method or scholarship of some sort, you'll be told that by people. That's the sort of mistakes we're all supposed to get rid of. Now we're educated people. We don't dismiss people based on this, that, and the other. In fact, you only look at the merits of the case if you're a rational person. And now here's a rational person who teaches at a university who pervasively dismisses people on an ad hominem argument. Well, they liked Jesus, so they obviously are lying or they're unreliable. Or they like Jesus because of the truth of which they're reporting about Jesus. That you just can't dismiss that a priori. I'm incorrigible. I just keep getting bogged down. 250. 251. Here we have reported for us three reasons that Aquinas offered for the reasonableness of the Christian faith. They're just above the middle of the page. You have the argument from prophecies. Secondly, the success of the Christian church without any promise of carnal pleasure in an afterlife or resort to violence. And third, miracles that have occurred, in this case, within the Christian tradition now. We're talking about miracles in the history of the church rather than miracles reported in the Bible. Now, at the bottom of the page, Michael Martin dismisses with these lines of evidence that Aquinas offers. In chapter 7, he says there are difficult obstacles that have to be surmounted with respect to miracle claims, and we're going to come to that in a second. And then he says, Aquinas appeals to the success of the Christian church. However, many churches or church equivalents inside and outside the Christian tradition have been successful in the way Aquinas specifies. And he offers at this point, anyway, no reply to fulfilled prophecy, which is interesting. I don't know why that got dropped. When you offer evidence to support Christianity, like evidence of the success of the church, you're suggesting an inference pattern that goes like this. If a religious body has in history been successful in the following way, then you should believe what they claim to be true. Now, if that is not your inference pattern, then that's not a legitimate form of argumentation for your Christian conclusions. But once you grant that as an implicit pattern of reasoning by which now Christianity was successful, so you should believe it, you leave yourself open for what? Counterexample. And that's what he does here. He says, well, the Muslims might say they've been, you know, outrageously successful in history too. However, Aquinas went beyond this. He said, but we've been successful without promising people carnal pleasure. And we haven't had to threaten people. Well, now when you make that kind of claim as an evidentialist, what's going to happen? Well, you're really going to get it socked to you, because people are going to say, what do you mean? Christians have persecuted people. They have a terrible reputation for that. Well, but we don't offer carnal pleasure as an incentive. We don't. Name it and claim it is not offering carnal pleasure to people. There have been Christians who do that. But even the more sophisticated, or what we might think more evangelical and orthodox ones, don't we offer people a life in the new heavens and the new earth, which is going to be so far surpassing any happiness we can have now that you can even describe it as having golden streets? Okay, one last move for the evidentialists. Yeah, but we don't offer to people who become believers, you can have all the women you want in the afterlife. No, which is true. You know, the Quran offers sexual pleasure to those who die in battle, for instance, as an incentive to be faithful to Islam. Now, is sexual pleasure something good or bad? Well, on hypothesis, it's good because it's in heaven, or in the new heavens and new earth, if you want to put it properly. And even on a Christian basis, sex is good. But of course, Aquinas lived in a day when there was a pervasive view of sex as a necessary evil. And so when Aquinas says, yes, but we don't resort to such necessary evils as you do to enjoy sex, that's not going to turn out to be very helpful to him as an evidentialist. In fact, I think that's going to embarrass him. But the point is, if God allows it in heaven, or in the new heavens and new earth, then it's not evil. And so why shouldn't God allow a lot of it? Now, all I'm getting at here is, for every move the evidentialist makes, the person who doesn't want to be moved by him can counter. It's just a game of intellectual chess now. It's like, you move here, I move there, so forth. You never get to the place where you can say, okay, enough of this, I want to know how you can move at all. So there's no transcendental challenge, and that's why evidentialism, I believe, is helpful to believers and can often embarrass unbelievers, and should have an effect because men are made in the image of God. But when you want to get down to the bottom line, apologetics has got to be made of tougher stuff than that. It's just too easy for an intelligent, I mean, how many pages? Over 500 pages in this book, and he dismisses evidential arguments in sentences. 255. Three quarters of the way down, there is little evidence that this or many of the other major events described in Scripture actually occurred. Indeed, in many cases, there is excellent reason to suppose that these events could not have occurred as portrayed. Why? Since they are portrayed in conflicting ways in different biblical accounts. Like a broken record, huh? Now let me ask you this. If something is portrayed in conflicting ways, I mean, by that assumption, is it not true that you should reject what is reported to have taken place?
Not necessarily.
It's not?
I mean,
only if you believe that both of the presentations are true. But if both are true, you have a conflict.
But wait a minute, that's not the way he did it.
No. I'm just working through the permutations here. So they can't both be true, can they? But now why didn't he take that possibility? Why didn't he say these are portrayed in conflicting ways, so they can't both be right?
Because one of his arguments was that just because it seems to contradict doesn't mean it doesn't. There are several times where he said, well, we don't have evidence yet, but someday we might, to him, in reference to a different argument for the existence of God. Kind of back away and say, well, you don't really know. I'm not working, right?
He assumes that neither of them.
Yes, and that's the problem I'm getting at. See, if he assumes both are true, then you've got a contradiction, so you can't have that. But one possibility is one's true and one isn't true. And he doesn't even consider that. Why? I'm going to tell you why. Because either one is going to upset the apple cart for him. Okay? I don't take this approach at all. But so we look at Matthew, we look at Luke and say, oh, look at that. We have a conflicting account of the birth of Jesus. They both say he's born of a virgin, but one's got it this way, one's got it that way. So obviously Matthew, let's say, is the one that's wrong. So that leaves me with Luke. But of course, if I'm left with Luke, I've got what? A virgin birth. We can't have that. And so what he's forced to say is they must both be wrong. But that isn't what logic requires of you. So he's not even playing by the rules of logic here. And again, I just want to drive home to you, this man is motivated to violate even the laws of logic and to reason by speculation that these things cannot be true. Okay, chapter 7. Let's see if we can quickly go through his argument about miracles. This is Harry Carey. I can't look at everything. Go right to the heart of it. Page 196, right in the middle. middle paragraph. This is the crux of it. He says, the believer in miracles must give reasons to suppose that the event E, the alleged miracle, will probably not be explained by any unknown scientific laws that govern nature. Nature in the broad sense here. Excuse me, in the narrow sense of the empirical world that we experience. I know that I've been hammering this man now for 3 days hard, and so it'll come as a surprise, but he's absolutely right. In terms of what is demanded for an argument for miracles, it's not enough that you convince a person that a certain event took place. Because when you say that event is miraculous, you're saying that what took place cannot be accounted for with our natural expectations by causal principles that operate in everyday life. Okay? So when evidentialists offer evidence, say, that Jesus was dead and then was alive, that can be accepted by an unbeliever, and you can say, fine, but I don't think that's a miracle. You say, well, it certainly is unusual. I say, yeah, it is very unusual. And it's also unusual for you to have opened the box of Raisin Bran and be the winner of the one prize that was put in the, you know, 596,000 boxes of Raisin Bran. They put a prize in one. Sure is unusual that you were the one. Now, would you say that's a miracle? It's not enough that it's unusual. It's unusual and what? Is not accounted for in terms of the way the world operates, the natural world operates. Now we have to add to this, though, no one knows everything about the operation of the natural world. And so philosophically speaking, Dr. Martin is correct. In order to label something a miracle, in the strict sense of the word, you'd have to be God. Now, since you'd have to be God to label it a miracle is not independent confirmation that God exists, is it? So now if somebody wants to make it independent, Michael Martin says, well, then you have to prove not only that this event took place, but as he says here, that it will probably not be explained by any unknown scientific laws that govern nature. Now, I've done him a kindness here in agreeing with his argument. That kindness is not intended, however, to deny the forcefulness of miracles as the Bible presents them. The Bible presents miracles as signs and wonders, powers, the sorts of things that ought to really move us, impress us, lead us to wonder in the presence of God. And they do unless what? Unless you suppress the truth and unrighteousness. So I believe in the evidentiary power of miracles. What I don't believe is in the independent evidentiary power of miracles. And that's because I think all evaluations of empirical events take place in terms of a worldview. So there's really no independent evidentiary power for empirical evidence for any event, as a matter of fact. But now I'd like to turn the argument about miracles around very quickly. Michael Martin might say, well, see, there you have it. You'd have to know everything to know this is a miracle, so you can't ever appeal to a miracle in order to disprove my naturalistic approach to the world, force me to believe in God. No, I've got a different kind of argument for miracles. Now I'm not being an evidentialist. You'll see that right away. Now my argument is, no, but you see, Dr. Martin, on your view of the world, everything's a miracle. Why is that? Since he cannot account for induction, even though he relies on it all the time, in a sense, every event that takes place is a disjointed event. In fact, he's willing to say some events are uncaused rather than to be forced to believe in God. So what I can say is, well, this is kind of strange. I can't twist your arm to make you believe that what we call miracles are miracles. But the only way you can get away from that is by saying everything's a miracle. Now, in one sense, though, the expression everything's a miracle is self-contradictory, isn't it? If you understand by miracle an event that has no causal precedent that can be proven, then everything is a miracle. But it's also the case that miracles are supposed to be what? Rare and wondrous occasions. And so how could everything be rare? And so he's got a view. I mean, what do you make of this? It's just so incoherent. Everything is uncaused. Everything lacks a rationally provable causal history. Well, if everything does, then everything's of equal, what, power in generating wonder. And what is that power? Zero. Everything's a miracle in what might be called the evil twin view of miracle. The evil twin where miracles are not wondrous, not powerful, and don't prove anything at all. So my argument for miracles, usually with unbelievers, is not the one that you hear from evidentialists. They go about the resurrection of Christ. However, I will tell you, sometimes you talk to people and they say, well, I'm just not sure I can trust the Bible. And I say, well, why not? They say, well, reports things like the resurrection of Christ. I know you'd have to believe that to be a Christian. I say, okay, why can't you believe that? They say, well, those sorts of things just don't happen. I say, well, you mean you've made up your mind in advance that it couldn't happen? You're just so prejudiced against it? And then they're embarrassed by that, and they'll say, well, why should I believe it? And I say, well, it's reported, you know, on pretty good grounds here in the New Testament. And then you start looking at things and say, well, why do you think the Apostle Paul, who persecuted the church, changed his mind? He said he changed his mind because Jesus appeared to him. You know, and you start going through it. And now what happens is somebody sees the coherence of the Christian way of putting all this stuff together. And seeing the coherence of all that, it does happen occasionally that people will say, I guess I didn't have a good reason to reject the resurrection. Well, I knew that they didn't have a good reason to reject the resurrection. And if at that point they say, I think I want to become a Christian, what do I need to do that? Obviously, I'm not going to stand there and say, no, wait a minute. You didn't realize this, but there's a tougher argument you could have used. You could have required me to prove that no natural explanation will ever be possible for this. Now, why do I not offer that to them? It's not because, hey, all I'm interested in is the sale, like a salesman. He goes, why should I tell about the defect in my product? You know, no, I've got somebody willing to sign on the dot. No, it's not for that reason at all. It's because I know that no natural explanation is going to be given, so why should I bother to bother somebody with that? How do I know that? Well, it all gets back to my worldview, doesn't it? God calls this a miracle. In fact, such a miracle that he says it gives evidence that Jesus will judge all mankind. So if I accept God's logic on this matter, I have no reason to suggest to people, well, maybe there's a natural explanation. So miracles do have evidentiary power. And sometimes it's enough for a person to say, I have no good reason not to believe, and I'm willing to believe. Praise God. However, many people, when they think this through, are either going to say, well, but all kinds of miracle claims are made, or miracles are impossible, I'm a naturalist, whatever it may be. Then you can argue for miracles in the way that I'm suggesting, that if you reject what the Bible says in order to escape its miracle claims, you end up making everything that happens a miracle. And then you've got real internal philosophical problems.
Don't Christians say in God's providence and sustaining the universe that since he sustains it all, every event is a miracle?
Right, we can get into a discussion, I had hoped we would, about how do Christians understand miracles, because on my view, every event that takes place is caused by God. Okay, like I lose, whatever, 12 hairs today from my head, I believe God caused them. I also believe that there are things that take place in natural sequences that caused it as well. So I hold to what's called dual causality. And I have no, you know, I'm not embarrassed by that sort of thing, though this philosopher ridicules that as over-explanation. He goes, now you've got too much of an explanation because you have dual causality. Well, on my worldview, that's not an embarrassment, so big deal. But now somebody might say, well, then, Dr. Bonson, on your view, everything's equally miraculous. I say, no, on my view, everything's equally under the sovereign control of God. But God doesn't sovereignly make cadavers rise all the time. And so now we do have, caused by God, it's supernatural and wondrous and unique and so forth.
Isn't that the case also that a miracle is embedded within a revelational context? It's not that while a man rose from the dead, how to interpret that, but it,
right.
It arises in a specific religion that has beliefs about these things.
Yeah,
so that when these things do happen, plus the words of Christ saying, I will die and I will be raised again.
Exactly.
You should then believe.
But what we have seen already is that all claims are seen in terms of a general context, clusters of beliefs, lifestyles, and that sort of thing. And so it's true that when we as Christians present the miracle claims of the Bible, they are miracles because of the way in which they're presented. In this context, where God raises the dead and so forth, that's a miracle. But now, could an evidentialist ever prove that God raised Jesus from the dead? Could you use empirical argumentation to show that God raised Jesus from the dead? A lot of evidentialists don't catch on to this question. They'll say, yeah, we can prove Jesus rose from the dead. You know? I say, that isn't the question. Can you prove that God raised Jesus from the dead? Even if you could prove that the event took place, you haven't proven that it took place by some transcendent intrusion of power, that God did this. And that's why, this is really just another way of saying what we've already said. And that's why you can never use a miracle, alleged miracle, as independent proof of Christianity. Because you'd have to already know that there's no natural explanation for this, and it had to be God who did it. In this chapter, which I referred to on our first day, and I'm just going to leave it at that now. In this chapter, Michael Martin has numerous illustrations of this arrogance that says, well, what credence can you give, you know, the views of people who lived in a superstitious age and things like that. And so his prejudices really come out very strongly. You may want to note that as you're going through this. Okay. We've looked at the elements of transcendental argumentation that can be found in the book, and even though they are not presented in the strongest form, even what is presented, he doesn't have a good answer for. And we've looked at how easy it is for somebody who doesn't wish to be moved off his presuppositions to deal with evidences from history and science that might be thrown at him. And so if nothing else, in our 3 days together, I hope I have demonstrated to you the value of evidences, but their strength only within a presuppositional framework. The only way you can finally get a person, you know, to the place where they consider the ultimate issue and reduce them to absurdity is through a presuppositional form of argumentation. Presuppositionalism also helps us to understand why people don't seem to be impressed by the use of evidences, and yet they can't escape Christian claims, they can't escape the challenge of the gospel if you go beyond the evidences to question how they can understand anything at all given their worldview. I'm going to change my strategy just a bit. Since we've been talking about evidences and the way in which we don't like the way Michael Martin treats them, I'm going to jump ahead to the case for Christianity and spend just a few minutes, I'm trying to regulate myself here, a few minutes in this book, and then I'm going to go back and look at the three major arguments against theism that are in the larger atheistic book, atheism book, the both atheism. This will have to be considered at best illustrative, and I'm just going to jump in here and look at the first major intrusion against Christianity. But it is so bad that if I can show you what's wrong with it, anybody should be able to read the other chapters and do the same thing to them. Over and over and over again, what you find taking place in this book is Michael Martin says, I've got another interpretation for you. I'm not meaning to oversimplify, but that's what it comes down to. Everything, it's going to be either I don't agree with you that I have to deal with this at all because it's implausible, or if it is there, I've got another interpretation. And so, in a sense, this book, as bad as it is in terms of showing how Christianity is true, it is of great apologetical value in showing you how unbelievers try to escape the evidence. And they always can dance around. What do you need to do when you have somebody who can write a whole book dancing? you better corner him, right? Make this guy sit down and face, you know, the argument. And the only way you can corner him is to stop him by saying, well, I can interpret this, I can interpret that. In the end, you can say, guess what? In your world, you can't interpret anything. From unbelievers is like this. Well, even if the Bible is the Word of God, you can't say for sure what it means because there are all these conflicting interpretations. And if God existed, there wouldn't be these conflicting interpretations. Therefore, apparently God doesn't exist. Okay? The argument from conflicting interpretations, that's not what you'd expect, therefore the Bible's not God's word or God doesn't exist. Now, the first thing I'm going to do as a presuppositionalist is I'm going to offer an alternative explanation of the agreed upon data. There are conflicting interpretations. Okay, we all admit that. Now, I point out to the person, well, you know, to be reasonable, you really should consider both of the relevant hypotheses. And these are relevant hypotheses. There is no God, and so that's why this is such a mess of a book and people don't interpret it correctly. Or there is a God, and because people are so messed up, they don't interpret his book properly. I mean, both are possible, right? I'm driving down the street and I get a real staticky, you know, reception on my radio. Maybe it's one of my favorite songs I'm listening to and I'm real upset about that. I pull over the side of the road, I call the radio station, I say, why are you messing up that Eagles song like that? Don't send it over the airwaves all garbled. And they say, we didn't. Have you checked your radio lately? You see, it's possible that my radio's messing up the signal. No, on the Christian view, God's sending a very clear signal. And because we are sinful, we're garbling it. And so the multiple interpretations doesn't count against God's existence at all, or the truth of the Bible. Now, I tell that, you know, to my opponent, my unbelieving opponent. I say, you've got really two views. You're going to have to eliminate the idea that it's God, and it couldn't possibly be us. And so he says, oh, okay, I guess it's really a standoff then. I said, no, actually, not quite a standoff. I do have one more thing I wanted to point out to you. And that's that if there is no God, everything's garbled. I'm just using my analogy here to save time. If there is no God, there's no possibility of interpreting anything accurately. And so what starts out as the opponent's attempt to say, oh, you've got problems, you can't get a real clear interpretation here, ends up to be the noose he puts around his own neck, because on his view you can't interpret anything. So you kind of see how evidences and presuppositions, you know, work together in apologetics. Page 3 in the introduction of the Case for Christianity. Michael Martin tells us in the middle of the page, it is well to remember that from the very start, Christianity has had its critics. Oh, this is dangerous stuff. Why is he telling us this? Well, he's trying to overcome the feeling people have that, well, it's very likely true because look at how many Christians there are. He goes, it's well to remember from the very start, people criticize this. So you shouldn't find it strange that I'm criticizing it. Now, how is that going to work against him? Because he also turns around and he tells us most of the stuff we have to account for can be dismissed because, what? People were not critically minded about it. You just had these free-floating stories among Christians. And poor Tacitus, can you imagine? He just listened to whatever the Christians said and he reported it. Well, that isn't quite true because he doesn't tell us very much. My guess is whatever Christians he listened to had a whole lot more to say about Jesus than what you get from him. Maybe what he reported is the only thing he thought was reliable. Yeah, if you had critics from the very start, you wouldn't be able, reasonably, to arrive at the interpretations that Michael Martin gives us in this book. Two-edged sword. Page 5, second paragraph. He says, an adequate systematic philosophical critique of Christianity hasn't yet been produced. The purpose of this work is to present such a criticism. Well, I'm going to point out logical fallacy after logical fallacy in just one chapter of the book. If this is supposed to be the adequate philosophical evaluation, it's a sad failure. And then he says, in the middle of the page, although I have elsewhere argued at length for atheism, this view will not be presupposed in what follows. Okay, I don't have to go over it all with you again. I'll just dismiss it with you. Yeah, right. I wrote a long book which convinces me that God doesn't exist, but I won't take that into account when I look at this evidence. Listen, not only does he take it into account, any of you who have read closely know that he's pulled off of his word processor verbatim portions of this book and put it into this one. I do the same thing. I'm not arguing that's any problem. But don't tell me he's not presupposing this. He actually physically pulls the text out of that book and puts it in here. Who's he fooling? He's fooling Michael Martin. Because Michael Martin doesn't want to believe that he's prejudiced. You know better. A little bit further down on the same page, my claim is simply that in the light of my discussion, rational people should give up these beliefs. Okay, now I've read his book, you read his book, I don't think anybody here is going to recant. I'm not giving up my Christianity here. Now what conclusion do you have to draw from that sentence?
Irrational.
That's right. I'm not a rational person. Which is interesting because I'm the one who keeps wanting to get him to offer us a justification to make sure that we are being rational when we use induction, the laws of logic, moral absolutes, and so forth. So a person who is dead set for a transcendental argument so that we can be rational is dismissed as not rational because what? Because I don't agree with his voluntary interpretations of the New Testament. When I say voluntary interpretation, I mean not compelled by the evidence. I can't keep him from believing that there's a conflict between Matthew and Luke. You know, he can choose to do that. That is one possibility. I don't think the text supports it, but then again, if you're presupposing atheism, that may be a more attractive interpretation than mine. I can't keep him from doing that. But the point is, he's calling me not rational for what? For not following his choices. Look at page 14. He says about the assumption of the Trinity and theism, I will not assume either its truth, theism, or falsehood. Well, we've already commented on that. He is assuming one or the other, because you can't proceed without assuming one or the other. And then he says, the doctrine of the Trinity has been critically evaluated by Michael Durant. And basically he's saying that so he doesn't have to get into all that. He's just saying, you know, go read Michael Durant. But then he slips a bit because he can't help but tell us that what Michael Durant has shown is this. He says, in fact, I can't add anything significant to his conclusion. He did such a good job of showing what? Quote, no intelligible account can be offered of the Trinitarian formula. Okay, so here you have an author who not only believes that the Trinity is not intelligible, he believes that it cannot be made intelligible, and he believes that that's been shown so sufficiently that he doesn't have to add anything to the demonstration. That's a very strong case. And then he goes on to tell us, even though no intelligible account can be given, however, I will not be assuming the falsehood of the Trinity in this work. Well, I'm not talking about psychological motive now. Other times I've said, I suspect he's hostile, you know, other sorts of things. You cannot, in one sentence, say, this is unintelligible, but I won't reject it. By saying it's unintelligible, you're not saying it's open for later investigation, I'll have to come back to this and decide. What you're saying is, it's decided. When you claim it's unintelligible, you've made the decision, forget it. All those claims are false, or you could say meaningless. And so he contradicts himself right on the same page when he claims neutrality. Okay, so you've got the elementary point. He's not neutral. Let's take as a sample of his argumentation, chapter 2 on the historicity of Jesus. Page 37. If the historical accuracy and trustworthiness of the Gospels are called into question, then the historicity of Jesus is called into question as well. Okay. That is what's known as the fallacy of sweeping generalization. Sweeping generalization. It doesn't follow at all that because details about Jesus are inaccurate, that the existence of Jesus is also called into question. That there may be reason to call his existence into question, but it cannot arise from the fact that there are some problems in the descriptions given. That is a fallacy of reasoning. Say that. Now, we have all kinds of independent things to run to escape my illustration, but it'd be like this. I've read a lot of books on the JFK assassination. And not only is it just a passing curiosity, but I find it a wonderful analogy to what people do when they engage in historical reasoning, you know, and they've got a commitment to a presupposition. So I have scholarly reasons, or if you will, professional reasons, to want to keep up on that and watch it. Well, you read in a book, and I've done enough of this that I know a little about it. So I read in a book claims about the place of Oswald at a certain time, or certain details about what happened when a bullet hit JFK and so forth. And I say to myself, oh, wait a minute, that detail's wrong. Apparently JFK didn't exist. See, as long as you jump right to it in a case that's well known, you can see what an asinine way of reasoning. But that's what he's doing. He's saying, well, these people who talk about Jesus, they don't get the details right, so I guess he didn't exist. And then in the next paragraph, this kind of expression is going to appear over and over again. It's important to realize that the historicity of Jesus is not something that has seemed to be an established truth to all biblical scholars and historians. Poor Michael Martin, the two-edged sword, he doesn't even realize how he's bleeding. Here he says, the vast majority of scholars accept the historicity of Jesus. But I want you to remember, not all of them, and if not all of them believe it, it's not an established truth. Now what's he do throughout the book? He turns it around and he says, some scholars say about this or that, and he openly acknowledges that other scholars don't agree with it, so he'd say, okay, not all scholars agree with you, and then he ends the book by saying, I have established that. All I want him to do is play by the same rules, you know, and he doesn't. When it's to his advantage, he dismisses the widespread scholarly opinion. And when it's to, I can say it the other way. When it's to his advantage, he's willing to go with the majority of scholars. When it's not to his advantage, he says, well, the majority's not always right. When it's the other way around, though, I mean, it's just arbitrary. Skepticism in the historical Jesus. He says a strong prima facie case challenging the historicity of Jesus can be constructed. He doesn't know how to use the English language. I say that politely. He doesn't know what a prima facie case is. Prima facie means on the surface of things, on its face, on first appearance, if you will. Okay? Well, the point is, on first appearance, even he admits it looks like Jesus is presented as a historical figure, and the vast majority of people read it that way. He tells us that you have to go and be critically minded. So after you go through all this torturous logic, then finally you say, oh, I guess he's not a historical figure. That's not a prima facie case. That's a case that's made upon re-examination. And then on top of it, apparently he doesn't know how to use the word strong when we're dealing with logic and argumentation. I'm not trying to play, you know, I'm not pulling rank on him. I could take this book, if I have friendly, unbelieving philosophers, and I know a few from graduate school days and other schools, I could set before them this form of argumentation and just ask them, is that what we call a strong argument? Because you see, when you're asking about the strength of an argument, you're not asking about its truth. That this disturbs some students of logic, but there are strong arguments for false conclusions. Okay? Usually we don't have all the information necessary. I'll give you a strong argument for my neighbor being on vacation, hypothetically. And say, I start mounting up the evidence. There are newspapers on his driveway. And in fact, there's about 10 or 12 newspapers. They haven't been picked up. The shades in his house have not been drawn for days. I haven't seen him open his garage door. Mail is now, you know, coming out of his mailbox. Hasn't been picked up. You know, I'm out of time, so I just can't entertain you. Fill out the rest of the story. Now, when I get done, somebody might say, there's a strong inductive case made here that your neighbor is gone. Until what? We find out that he had a heart attack and died, and his body's been in the house all this time. Now, with that information, what happened to my strong case? Not strong at all. So you can make a strong inductive case for something that's false, as a matter of fact. You can also make a strong deductive case for a position that's false. Well, of course, what that tells you, if it's a deductive, is that one of your premises is false, too. Anyway, there's a difference between a strong case and a case for that which is true. Now, he wants to say, I'm gonna show the truth of something. But he says that his case is prima facie, which it's not, and secondly, that it's strong, which it's not. Not in any normal use of the word strong. Page 38. Skepticism about the details of Jesus' life can generate skepticism about his very existence. That's the same fallacy repeated. Now he gives us the argument that he prefers about the historicity of Jesus from G.A. Wells. And what's he tell us about Wells' argument? Just pick up these clues. Wells stresses that his skepticism concerning the historicity of Jesus is based in large part on what? The view that the canonical Gospels were written by unknown authors not personally acquainted with Jesus. Okay, well, if his case rests upon that, let's imagine that's a nail that's from which all the rest of it's hanging. Then all I have to do is attack that. If I pull that nail out, everything else crashes to the ground, doesn't it? You know what happens, though, when somebody challenges the idea that the Gospels were not written by unknown authors who are not personally acquainted? Michael Martin tells us that that's not plausible. Yeah, or better yet, thank you. Hit us footnote it, you know? Or we get expressions like this. Most modern scholars say. So you have an entire elaborate argument which is contrary to the prima facie evidence, hanging from a nail, which when the nail is challenged, he defends it by saying most modern scholars. Or, well, that's not plausible.
It's funny how he reversed the criteria. Before, Christian evidence was not admissible because it was Christian. Now he's using just the opposite because they knew Jesus.
That's great, Bill. I hadn't thought about that. That is a wonderful example. You notice that these are supposed to be Christian scholars who admit this. The one defect is you and I probably wouldn't call them Christians. But nevertheless, they think they're followers of Jesus in whatever liberal form. And so they're Christians on, you know, Michael Martin's approach. Why is it that the early Christians are too prejudiced to be believed, but later Christians, you can take their testimony? What's determining the moves in argument here? Well, you see, his prejudices, his presuppositions, over and over and over again. To be very honest with you, maybe I've made it strong enough already, but I can illustrate this. If I were not debating Michael Martin, and I had not promised to teach a course on this book, ordinarily, in my reading, I try to read books in other situations too, if I would have gotten this far with this many fallacies, frankly, I would have just put it up on the shelf and say, this is worthless. It's a waste of my time. I would like to believe, I don't know what would happen, you know, if I weren't a believer. But I'd like to believe, given what I've been taught in terms of scholarship, I'd do the same thing if I were an unbeliever. Unless I was looking for some way to make up interpretations, oh, here's some interesting ideas how to escape it, I'd say, why would anybody believe this sort of thing? All the moves he makes are dictated not by the merits of the case, but by what? Considerations outside of the argument. Personal considerations, presuppositions, what have you. A little above the middle of the page. According to Wells, they also admit that there is much in these accounts that is legend, and that the gospel stories are shaped by the writer's theological motives. Uh-oh. Theological motives have entered in here? Okay. Isn't this the pot calling the kettle black? But also, I want you to notice that when he says shaped by the writer's theological motives, I agree with that. There's no doubt in my mind that the reason why the Gospels read differently is because the different Gospel writers had different interests and different theological points they wanted to cover. And I don't believe that they conflict at all. Jesus is presented as the King of the Jews in Matthew's Gospel. That's not real heavily stressed in Luke. Is that a conflict? No, Luke was a Gentile, writing for Gentiles. Why would I expect him to make that the centerpiece of his literary organization, if you will? So yeah, I agree that these are shaped by theological motives. But it's altogether a different claim to say they imagined these things out of theological motivation. That's really what he has to show us. It's not that the presentation has been formed by the author's theological interest. He needs to show us that the author's theological interest led him to lie or to be so gullible as to believe myth and legend and so forth. Given this situation, Wells says, a rational person should believe the accounts of the Gospels only if they are independently confirmed. Okay, a rational person should believe the accounts of the Gospels only if they're independently... I think we've covered that enough. A few lines down. Although these earliest writers certainly believe that Jesus lived and died, Wells maintains that they do not provide any support for the thesis that he lived early in the first century. Thus, those Pauline letters now admitted to be genuine by most scholars, and those letters that are considered probably or possibly authentic are silent about the parents of Jesus. Well, this is nothing less than a fallacious argument from silence. Okay, I admit that Paul wrote at least some of this, and he wrote it in the first century. But Paul, who wrote this, and he's the earliest writer, doesn't mention the parents of Jesus, the place of his birth, his trial before Pilate. By the way, that's not true. He does mention it in 1 Timothy. But, of course, we've got an answer for that. 1 Timothy comes from the second century. Isn't that interesting? You know the old joke about the evolutionists, the way they date the fossil record? Well, they'll say, the fossils show, you know, evolutionary development. Because when you date them, you see these kinds of fossils are earlier than those kind of fossils. And so people will say, wow, that's pretty interesting. And then you go to, you know, college and you get involved in paleontology and so forth, and you find out how they date the fossils. They date the fossils according to a presumed evolutionary history. And so it's like, who's paying the bill here? They keep passing it back and forth. Evolution's paying the bill for the dating. The dating's paying the bill by appealing to evolution. I mean, which is it? And that's what he's doing here. He says, Paul doesn't even refer to Jesus' trial before Pilate. You say, yes, he does. Oh, well, then it's not really a Pauline letter. Okay. At least he has a coherent theory, or he thinks he does. He's trying to draw a picture where everything fits into place. But he's telling us the gospel writers shouldn't be allowed their theological motivations, and yet he's got a theological motive for what he's doing as well. Okay, now the question might arise, why is it that the Pauline epistles do not reflect Jesus' teaching and life? I've already said, well, as a matter of fact, they do. And later in the book, in this very chapter, he'll have to admit that too. Paul does refer to certain things. His early argument is, Paul doesn't refer to the details of Jesus' life. Then later he says, well, yeah, he does refer to being born of a woman, being crucified, rising from the dead. This is disreputable. As though, hey, he doesn't talk about very much important, does he? He does refer to these things, but later in the chapter, I'm having to jump ahead because I'm not going to make it time-wise. Later in the chapter, when he admits this, he goes, but he doesn't give a lot of precise details. It's like you will just not be satisfied. How many of you know the story of the insane Blick? Have read it or heard about that? Okay, not many. Well, real briefly, in this whole discussion of the meaningfulness of religious language and the fact that religious language resists falsification, you have one person who tried to explain that by saying, well, yeah, sometimes people hold to what is a Blick or a perspective. In the nature of the case, it resists falsification. So here's my Blick. Let's say I tell you, I think everybody, not everybody, but you know, there are a lot of people. Maybe they're in the OPC. They're out to kill me. That's why I lock the doors, you know, and I close the windows and so forth. They're out to get me. And I don't ever go out without somebody with me, and I have a bulletproof vest on. Somebody, you know, is a little worried about maybe Dr. Bonson's going a bit bonkers. And so he says, well, now, Dr. Bonson, you're a rational man. Not everybody in the OPC is out to get you. And I say, no, I didn't say everybody. I said almost everybody. Okay, okay. Well, but it doesn't appear like there's a lot of people who are trying to kill you. Oh, they are. I say, well, but then why is it that they allow you to be a minister in this denomination? It's a trick. They're trying to gain my confidence so they can finally draw me away to a General Assembly meeting somewhere where I'm not protected, and then they're going to kill me. You say, no, wait a minute, Dr. Bonson. They allow you to publish in their denominational magazine. Another trick. They're trying to get my confidence. Now, I don't have time to tell you the whole story of how the OPC is persecuting me. You know what makes it hard is there might be some evidence of genuine persecution that's added in there, too. I mean, I'm paranoid, right? But I do think there is some evidence of that. But now, when you have somebody, though, that will not be affected by counter-examples, what do you make of that kind of person? They are so committed to their conclusion that, in fact, evidence will not be allowed to touch them. And I'm now going to make the claim that Michael Martin is so committed to Jesus not being the Son of God that he'll argue one way, and then when you satisfy what he wants there, he'll change the argument or the demand of the argument, and then when you match that one, he'll change it again. He'll never move in the direction of refutation. Now, what we've learned over the years, or what many people have argued over the years, is that people who resist falsification are not making meaningful claims at all. Now, I think he is making meaningful claims. I don't buy that approach. But it's ironic, isn't it, that it's the unbeliever who resists falsification. He's the one who's always got another explanation and another explanation and another explanation. So his fine, brash hypothesis, I have established Christianity's false, dies the death by inches of 1,000 qualifications. Well, the earliest writers don't refer to the details of Jesus' life. Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, Paul refers to Jesus standing before Pilate. Oh, well then, it wasn't Paul then who said that. Well, in the ones that you do recognize to be Pauline, he does refer to the details of Jesus' life. Very important ones. Yeah, but not with precise details. This is an insane Blick. That's what we have here. Okay, real quickly, four expressions on page 39. At the end of the first paragraph, it seems likely then that Paul simply did not know what Jesus was supposed to have taught according to the Gospels. Likely? On what presuppositions? on what presumptions? Likelihood is always against this evidence understood in this way. He says, it seems likely. At the beginning of the third paragraph, Wells argues that scholars agree, selectivity, tendentious selectivity, scholars meaning the ones I agree with, a few lines down, maintaining that it is difficult to explain. Well, who decides what is difficult in an explanation? And then the second to the last line on the page, but Wells suggests another interpretation of the passage. Well, that's the name of the game. Every time you get a passage that's troublesome, we've got another interpretation. We've always got somewhere to run. Top of page 40, second line, he refers to not what one might reasonably expect. What is this? Four paragraphs? And he's been nailed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times for begging the question. What is reasonable? Who are the scholars? What is likely? And then in the middle of the page, moreover, although the wisdom literature does not state explicitly that wisdom lived on earth, blah, 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 Wells argues that these ideas are suggested by some passages. So not only is it alternative interpretation, it doesn't even have to be found in the text. Now an alternative interpretation is good enough if it's suggested by. This is so weak, it's pathetic. He tells us there was a tradition about the crucifixion of holy men in Palestine in the 1st and 2nd centuries B.C. And then my text says that alluded to Dead Sea Scrolls. He must mean which is alluded to in the Dead Sea Scrolls or something. Anyway, he says there is this tradition about the crucifixion of holy men. And Wells tells us in this quotation, historical tradition about crucifixion some 2 centuries before may then have confirmed in Paul's mind the suggestions of the wisdom literature.
Dr. Boston, another thing, he uses like Josephus, when he wants to accept Josephus, he uses them as a backup. But obviously when we use Josephus to back up as a second source, that was changed by the Christians.
Yeah, that's right. It's always an interpolation that's unreliable. So, I don't know, am I boring you? You got the evidence over and over and over again of a double standard here. What Wells is talking about historical tradition is, we're supposed to believe that Paul was familiar with the wisdom literature, and then for the last 100 years or so, there was a tradition of holy men being crucified, and so Paul, pretty clever of him, says, well, the wisdom literature talking about God's wisdom coming on earth might then be crucified as a holy man. Now, this is explanation by roast pig. You can say anything you want, can't you? Speculation for speculation. Now, the difficulty is about this tradition of holy men being crucified. If Paul was so ready to make up a story about wisdom walking on earth being a man who was crucified, a holy man being crucified, why do we have the dullness in the followers of Christ in their expecting him to die and the shame that was connected with the crucifixion? That is, this is incoherent if you read the New Testament. The New Testament makes, what's that?
Did you say been expecting him?
They did not expect it.
Did not.
They were right. Why is it that they were surprised or fought against the idea? It would appear that Judas turned about against Jesus when he couldn't, you know, get the idea that he was going to be a victorious Messiah. Peter was not about to have a suffering Savior. You know that. They were so ashamed that they all denied him. Hebrews refers to the shame of the cross. Paul tells us the preaching of the cross is scandalous. If you read the New Testament, nobody's going to go, if they're going to make up a story about wisdom walking on earth, make wisdom crucified. But then again, if you don't want to believe the Bible, you're more inclined to say, I think people made that up. And I said, well, what about all the indications of the shamefulness of crucifixion? Well, that probably wasn't reliable. Or they already believed that crucified people were probably holy men, so it was really an indirect compliment. Well, it doesn't fit the other evidence then. You know, we got him coming and going, but the point is, he'll dance from pillar to post to get what he needs.
He makes one statement in 38, I guess conclusively. He says, furthermore, the evidence provided by the Gospels is exclusively Christian.
Yeah, it means it's motivated.
That's damning to the whole argument.
Yeah. That's kind of like saying everything we know, well, this is not true about Luther, but by some other person, is from historians that were favorable to him.
So why should we take his argument about atheism if he's coming from an atheistic perspective?
How about this? All those footnotes that we were sent to go read about God not existing, we don't have to bother now because we know you only footnoted them because they agreed with you.
Yeah.
Terrible argument. Bottom of page 40. One factor that may have caused a radical change in Christian belief was the Jewish war. Notice speculation now. We have double standards, speculation, prejudice. But this is a beaut. He says the dispersion caused by the Jewish war of Palestinian Christians breaks the continuity in the Christian church with Palestinians. And so it was difficult for Christian writers to have reliable information about Palestinian Christianity. Stop and think about it, sports fans. Isn't the argument reversible? The Jewish war that dispersed Christians, Palestinian Christians all over the world, disseminated the reliable information they had. Praise God, in one sense, for that persecution. Otherwise, maybe the only reliable information we'd have would be from writers of that period at that point. But because they took this reliable information with them, now obviously I have a presuppositional difference with it. He says in the next paragraph, the first writers to connect Jesus with Pontius Pilate were active in Gentile Christian communities and had only hazy ideas about Palestine. Okay, so they're vague about this. Jump down to the bottom of the page, though. This is great. Well, maybe two-thirds of the way down. If they only had vague ideas, why is it that we get something like crucified under Pontius Pilate? And now the answer is, I mean, why did Christians seize on the historical person Pilate? Why would these Christians have assumed that Pontius Pilate was Jesus' murderer? Remember, there is no Jesus. There's just the story of wisdom walking on earth that probably was crucified as a holy man. Well, who would crucify wisdom as a holy man? Part of the story is, well, I bet Pontius Pilate did it. Why did they seize on Pontius Pilate? Because he was, listen, infamous for his ruthless rule in Judea. Well, in my book, I've got a line written between the first sentence about Judea and the last. The first one says what? You can't count on what comes from there, because they only had hazy ideas. Now we have, why did they have Pontius Pilate? Because of the infamy in Judea of Pontius Pilate. You can't have it both ways. Is it we only have hazy information, or do we have infamous information? Those are contradictory assumptions, and so he's engaging in special pleading, isn't he? And then when he talks about Gentile Christians having only hazy ideas about Palestine, has he not read the evidence about Luke, who wrote the gospel and got the titles of political figures right and details of geography right and all sorts of things? That's been amazing to scholars for years. And he's a Gentile. He didn't grow up in Judea. Obviously, I'm not impressed with his arguments, and I think I've got impressive ones to counter him with. But obviously, he's not touched by my arguments. And I'm not touched by his. What's going on here? Wells concludes his argument by saying, bottom of the page, those who lack understanding of the process whereby myths are formed are apt to argue that. And I put in the margins, those who are not informed about the process of myth, those who don't understand myth formation, like Wells himself. You see, even on Wells' hypothesis, there is not enough time for the development of these myths about Jesus after the time when they could possibly be checked. That's an awkward sentence. At the time that Wells says these things were written, you're still close enough to the generation of Jesus' hearers that they could have checked it. Myths don't develop that way. What happens is, if you let this go for 200, 300, 400 years, then traditional stories start building up that are attached to a name that might not be historical. But how could a legend develop, even in the first century, with a name Jesus attached to it, when people could have checked it? That is not the way legends develop. And yet he has the audacity to say that those who disagree with him don't understand the process of myth formation. And this is crucial, middle of page 42. He goes through the long form of argument for not trusting these things. He says that a rational person surely would have good grounds for being skeptical. In a sense, I agree with that. I don't agree with the assessment that a person is actually rational. I'm not saying a person is actually rational, but I am agreeing that a person can put up what appears to be a rational defense if he wishes to. That is, if a person wishes to, he can resist and offer reasons which, if his conclusion is true, will seem good and adequate. But notice the qualifiers there. If he wishes to, and if his conclusion is true, he can offer such reasons. But interestingly, that's the very thing we're supposed to be debating, right? Is your conclusion true? And are you doing this just because you wish for it to be that way? And then I say at the bottom of my page, what makes one rational reconstruction more plausible than another? What is it? I've got an interpretation, he has one. I've got an explanation, he has one. I've got a rational reconstruction of what happened in the early days of the church, he's got a rational reconstruction. Rational in the sense that he can make it look scholarly, I can make mine look scholarly. Who is it that's plausible here? What are the grounds for plausibility? How about simplicity? That explanation is more plausible, that's more simple. Well, I think he's got a pretty complicated theory. I've got a real simple one. God sent his son into the world. He lived and died, just as the text tells us, and so forth. That is, that it happened just this way is simple. To explain away the text requires you to become complicated. So we don't want simplicity to be in there. So what makes one explanation more plausible than another? I don't know. I hope, if nothing else, you learn from our short discussion here that even when certain empirical data is agreed to, no belief will be tested. We're only looking at one belief. Did Jesus exist historically? No belief will ever be tested in isolation. And therefore, no one belief is ever falsified by or confirmed by empirical evidence. And I'm going to have to leave it at that. Michael Martin is just one long illustration of that. He is prejudiced. He violates the rules of logic. He's willing to say what I think are implausible things, anything to get away from the evidence for the conclusion that Christ is the Son of God. But as long as I let him only look at one belief at a time, he'll always have the ability to do that. And so the answer in apologetics is to make sure that you force people to argue competing worldviews, clusters of beliefs.